Test,好。Hello，Hello，Hello。
These are not the most comfortable with glasses, but
is it okay?
Yeah.
Hello, testing.
Well, probably we could take it after, I would say. If I'm only 45 minutes, so probably better to take it after so I cover the material. I plan to.
Okay. It'd be good if you can put in so far at least.
Okay. Okay. How hard a deadline do we have? Okay, if we could go over a few minutes,
yeah,
so maybe.
What happens if people online might send questions to Niels?
Oh, okay.
It's not always happening, so. Let's say we have about 35 registered online.
Oh, okay, great. And this is probably about.
Can you find out if they're from Sweden? He gave some information to people in Sweden. Do we have the IP address?
All this really working, it sounds very cool.
Hello, hello, yeah. Maybe it's not turned on.
It doesn't look on.
No, it's on up here. It says on?
Yeah.
It's just, I don't know, you can.
Hello, hello. Yeah, right, exactly. Right. Nice ball. My wife will like it.
That's what
exactly.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the third NEET lecture of the year. It's a pleasure to see that you keep running present both in the auditorium and online. It's a great pleasure to have Bud Lawson here together with us today, who will give us an introduction to the birth of the pointer variable, and he will also hopefully come touch up on some of the consequences that this has had for information security.
Okay.
The stage is yours.
Thank you very much. Well, pleasure to be here in Juvik. And actually what has happened is last year I was asked, or 2 years ago, to write a chapter for a book on computer history by the International Federation of Information Processing. And so the book was actually published by Springer. And so I've had a long career starting already in 1958 in the computer business. And I've had a lot of experiences, and as you know, life is a happening, so I've changed position, I've changed countries, I've changed most everything in my life as a result of that. I was able to document, I think, a pretty good reflection of my experiences, and I published it in a chapter which I called Experiences and Reflections of a Computer Pioneer. And one of the things, and I have presented this as a seminar, it usually takes a little over 2 hours. When I was asked by Stuart to do this, he said, well, you have 45 minutes. So I decided instead of producing the whole experience from 1958 to today, I would concentrate on the first part, which has some interesting implications for computer history. And one of the significant events that happened at that point in time was the birth of the pointer variable in 1964. And I was the designer of that particular facility. And in year 2000, I became one of about 100 computer pioneers in the world and was given this very nice Charles Babbage medal. as a result of that. So, anyhow, okay. The whole picture goes about overlapping phases. I would say from 58 I began, and I will understand why in a moment. From 59 to 74 I worked related to computer industry, both in developing system softwares and developing hardwares. So I've done both. And that's an interesting perspective. And then phase two, which I'm not going to go into, for 74 to 96, I've been involved in developing a variety of computer-based systems where we applied computers in very sophisticated applications, power control, automatic train control. In fact, the automatic train control system you have in Norway, I designed. It's the same as was in Sweden. in 1976 to 77, and then a number of other control systems of various varieties. But since 96 approximately, and these years are overlapping, I've been focusing upon complex systems which involve both technical and non-technical systems and could be involved in the area of information security or other types of issues related to what we have as problems in complex systems. And as we'll come to later, I've developed a book about that, which we have a copy of down here. If you want to have a look at that. Okay. Well, I've dedicated this presentation to all the colleagues I work with, and that's over all these periods. We have a lot of fun, and we learn from each other. But I will be pointing to some interesting reflections and happenings, and we'll do that in red. Now, in addition to being an industry person, which I've been, I happened to have started a parallel academic career in 1967 when I became professor at the Polytechnic Institute of Brooklyn in New York. And there's very reasons why I left at that time IBM and went to academia, but since then, I've been in and out of various universities around the world as well, and have contributed. We had, at that time, 67, I defined one of the first computer engineering programs in the United States. There were only two or three universities that had computer engineering. Carnegie Mellon was one of them. Okay, but we were quite early on. Okay, so to summarize this computer industry, that first phase, and what we're going to focus upon today. In the summer of 1958, between my last 2 years at college, I happened to have an internship at the United States Census Bureau, which is the big statistics gathering organization of the United States. And they were one of the first ones to use commercial computing. We did get an introduction to computing there, and I had shared a room, an apartment with a colleague who had actually done some programming and got insight into what computing was about. During my last year, I went to Temple University in Philadelphia. Temple University decided to buy an IBM 650 drum computer, which was a rotating magnetic drum, which was a very interesting program. The memory was rotating all the time, and you have algorithms for delay time, etc. But anyhow, the faculty was given an introductory course, and since I was a lab instructor at the time at Temple, my last year, I was asked if I would like to join. So, because I had some hum about computing, I was much better than the rest of the faculty, which was kind of embarrassing. So I actually got my programs to work. But anyhow, that last year at Temple was an interesting. As a kind of small parenthesis, I went to Temple with a scholarship for track and field. So I used to run quite fast. And one of my more astute colleagues was somebody you probably know, Bill Cosby, Dr. Huxtable, in the comedy series. Bill and I were on the same track team together. Ran in the relays. So, an interesting character. Okay, that's a small issue. Okay, but I did, during that last year, my professor saw that there was a lecture down at the University of Pennsylvania given by a woman that was going to talk about teaching computers to understand programs expressed in English. And that sounded very interesting. So I went down and had listen to that, and after that I found that, well, that really was exciting. So I applied for a job at Remington Rand UNIVAC where this woman worked, and I got the job. So my first job in 59 in Philadelphia was working for a woman by the name of Dr. Grace Murray Hopper, who's kind of a legend in computing. And we'll look at a bit at that in a moment. I was there 2 years. And then I went on to IBM, and it was during this time at IBM that, amongst other things, I developed the pointer variable concept. Then I've been consulting in the computer industry as a professor part-time. Then I left for a leave of absence and went out to California and was co-architect of a hardware called the MLP900, which was to emulate various different machines. It was a very interesting new concept at the time. As a result of that, that computer aroused quite a bit of interest in Europe. And so there was a plan for the Swedish computer manufacturer Datasaab to license that machine and use it. For various reasons, that didn't happen. We had a working prototype of the machine, the MLP900, but the company changed direction by changing management. And so I went back to Brooklyn, but Datasaab and even ICL in England was interested in the machine. So Datasaab said, well, can't you come over and help us design a machine similar to that? So I came over as a consultant to Datasaab in 71 to 73. So I designed the last large machine in Sweden. Okay, this was before the microprocessor arrived. Okay, so life was different then. The microprocessor changed everything. Okay, but it was an interesting experience. And I designed a very advanced machine that could be reused in many different ways. And since then, I kind of left the computer industry as a proper thing, but I've been involved as a consultant from time to time and even expert witness, because several of the inventions I did in hardware have been the subject of patent disputes. So I've been called in as expert witness a couple times. Okay, so that's a little bit about the background from that perspective. I'd like to speak a little bit about this first boss I had, because he was worth a whole lecture. Rear Admiral Dr. Grace Mary Hopper. She was quite a person, and she was, I would say, one of the early programmers in the world in modern times. She, of course, minted the word bug, which we all use. When she was programming the Mark I computer at Harvard University, which was his electromechanical computer during this, the latter part of the Second World War, so a moth flew into one of the circuits and the machine stopped functioning. And she took this fried moth out of the machine and put it in her logbook with a piece of tape and said, "There's a bug in the system." So, you know the origin of the word bug. In fact, that logbook is in the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, so if you ever get there, you can have a look at it. But she also minted the word compiler in 1951. And the idea of compiling, of course, means putting things together, which is, of course, what a compiler does, basically. So she had this first idea, which was a mathematical set of mathematical subroutines and functions that she could compile and put together with some type of command language, and that she called a compiler. But that was actually the start of the first way of writing programs at another level of abstraction. She developed then, from this A0, became a commercial product of UNIVAC called Mathematic, which happened to have come out before Fortran, okay, or about the same time as Fortran. Then Grace observed that the future of computing was probably not so much in computation but in data processing. So she developed a language called B0, which was more for dealing with commercial applications. That became a commercial product called Flowmatic, and that inspired the development of COBOL. And many people, if you go into the do a web search, they say that she's the creator of COBOL. She inspired COBOL. She wasn't the creator of COBOL, but certainly had an important role in COBOL's development and all COBOL's use, as a matter of fact. But Grace loved the U.S. Navy. She became the oldest active officer, retired at 80. She got reactivated several times during her career. When I worked for her, one day a week she came in her uniform, because she was at the Philadelphia Navy Yard. She had a meeting one evening every week, so we used to see her in the uniform. But she was a very, very special person, and she did a lot of things. She always liked to do things contradictory to others, so she had a clock in her room that went backwards. And everybody came in and looked at the clock and said, "Grace, that clock's going backwards." "Well, that's no problem. The clock is behind me, and I have a mirror on the wall in front of me." That's a typical Grace story. But anyhow, from Grace I learned that the important question of the status quo, to seek deeper meaning and to explore alternative ways of doing things, and I think that has affected me for the rest of my life. She was really quite a person that, in that regard. So, and this happened to be Grace and myself. This was at a ceremony in 1980. She became an honorary doctor at Linköping's University, same time I was installed as a professor in Linköping. And the evening before, I gave a lecture called UNIVAC Compiler Technology in the 1950s, where I went through this development, and she just sat there and smiled. She thought it was great. I've only done that lecture one time. I should probably do it another time sometime. But then there's a naval ship called the Hopper, and remember her memory, I actually sent some material that's historical material that they put in the hull of the Hopper. And I was invited to the ceremonies for introduction, but I didn't go, unfortunately. Okay, these early programming languages is mathematic. This was a mathematic program to do computation, not to go through it in detail, and this was a Flowmatic language, expressed somewhat differently. So those were the two very early programming languages. And as I said, I started there in June of 59. At that time, there was an effort going on to define the COBOL programming language. Okay. So we actually got involved in the then planning for the implementation of the first COBOL compilers. So the machine that we were going to do this was a UNIVAC 2, which had as much as 2K words of memory. That's a lot, right? Each word was 12 decimal digits or characters, and it had up to 10 tape drives. No hard disks. Okay. A powerful, intuitive instruction set of only 26 instructions, which you could learn. You could really program that quite easily at the machine level, it turned out. There was an offline typewriter and card punch, card to tape and printer. Okay, the COBOL implementation. Grace insisted that we look at the compiler as a data processing system. Okay, so that was the philosophy. He said, well, you're going to define various passes which are going to do various transformations on the source program, and eventually at the bottom will pop out this object program, right? Okay, so that was the philosophy. Now, the other thing that was interesting, this compiler was not implemented in assembly language, it was implemented in Flowmatic, which was the data processing language. So we actually implemented the compiler in Flowmatic. And it had approximately 60 passes. By that, I mean tape-to-tape conversions. Okay, so it took 45 minutes to compile anything, something like that. I did the initial parser and the code generator and part of the input-output facilities. I called the code generator DOES. At that time, there was a soap detergent in America called Does, and the advertisement was, Does everything. And that was a pretty good description of this central part of this compiler. It did everything. So since it was a decimal machine without any floating point, I developed some generalized algorithms for decimal alignment, and that was an interesting experiment. But there was a parallel implementation done at RCA, Radio Corporation America, in Camden. They had a computer there, and they developed a COBOL implementation at the same time. But in December 1960, an interesting event happened. For the first time in history, the same program was compiled and executed on two machines from the same source program. So that's a point in history. December 1960. I happened to give a seminar in 1999 at the Computer History Museum at Stanford University with Howard Bromberg, who had actually worked for Grace Tiedegger earlier, but he was taking a lead for the group at RCA. And we had a very nice seminar at Stanford University. A former student of mine is, incidentally, the chairman of the board of the Computer History Museum in Palo Alto, Leonard Shostak. Well, not to bore you with the details, this is a schematic of DOES. DOES does everything. Interesting thing, I call this a service network. Okay, this is in 1960. Okay. And by creating a and really it taught me about structuring programs, because by doing that I could do things that just as calling sequences to these service routines and handle most all of the code generation activities. So I learned a lot about programming and about structuring programs as a result of that. But Grace was not a very manageable person. She was often in conflict with corporations management. So she always didn't hesitate to do things to get things her way. And that really got people annoyed at the management level. So she actually returned to Navy service at the Pentagon, and several members of her automatic programming department, including myself, left Sperry UNIVAC at the time. But there was an interesting thing that I would like to point out. There was an important World War II slang term that crept into our department vocabulary, and that's blivet, sometimes spelled in two different ways. Of course, we have in Swedish blivet, but I don't know if in Norwegian there's an equivalent. But anyhow, the blivet was defined as follows. In traditional military slang dating back to the Second World War, the blivet is defined as 10 pounds of shit in a 5-pound bag. Okay. A proverbial description of anything ugly or unmanageable. It was applied to a non-manageable situation, a crucial but substandard damaged tool, or a self-important person. Okay. So that has influenced my life. So I've dedicated the rest of my life to blivet avoidance. Okay, and blivet avoidance, for me, has been finding the limiting number of concepts and principles that guide thinking, influence decision-making, and provide a controlled means of acting. So I define that as blivet avoidance. Okay, but we see many examples of blivets. We'll look at some in a few moments. Okay, that have evolved under history of computing. Okay, my first professional publication was in 1962 at the ACM National Conference in Syracuse. I actually had left UNIVAC and started to work for IBM. But as we see here, if we look at this description here, the analysis and verification of a data hierarchy utilized in COBOL prevents a major problem for implementation of the language. It was the first language that defines data structures, okay, of heterogeneous elements. That didn't exist before. Okay. And from the compiler point of view, then I just discovered that the use of chainless matrices presented in this paper provides a significant aid in reducing the time required to process the variably structured data elements in a COBOL program. So these chainless matrices have been developed to provide a means for classifying and relating elements of a tree structure. Offered are definitions of tree terminology, such as node, branches, roots, leaves, subtrees, branching trees, branching ratios, etc. Examples that explain the structure and meaning of the arbitrary order, level order, and subtree order chain matrices will also be presented. So this was my first publication, and it was based around our experience with COBOL earlier. As I said, it was at IBM. So this was based on that. It turned out that one interesting person that attended that session, who I didn't know him at the time, is Donald Knuth. And Don and I have been good colleagues for many, many years since then. But how many are familiar with his book, The Art of Computer Programming? Not too many. That's unfortunate. That's kind of the seminal book about computing. It's called Fundamental Algorithms. And Don cites this paper as the first publication of algorithms for multi-linked data structures. So I was pioneering, I guess, in that sense as well. But this provided a good basis for my eventual work with the pointer variable, because I understood how to link things together. okay, and get programs to do that and algorithms to do that. So that provided a good basis. So then what happened? I will first go through my time at IBM and then relate to the pointer variable concept, which was further development, because, okay. Well, my time at IBM first began in a research group on compiler techniques. In particular, slang, which is system language, was based around an instrumented Backus neural form notation, which was quite interesting. You could describe and generate parsers automatically, and you could then provide semantics related to that, and was a very nice way of quickly producing compilers. Okay. Much better than what we did with the COBOL compiler, which was 60 passes on the UNIVAC 2. Okay. But this was on a IBM 7090. Well, in 1963, IBM announced the System 360, which was both a step forward and a step back. Step forward in that was the first time that one would produce a uniform architecture for both commercial computation and scientific computation. Previously, IBM had machines that were oriented toward one or the other. Okay, but this was the first time. And so there was an effort to define that. So they also decided the fact that, well, if we're going to have that, we should probably have a language that you could do either numerical computation or data processing, etc. So they got the idea of developing a language called PL1, which would combine the facilities of Fortran, COBOL, and ALGOL into one language. Okay, and so that was specified, and actually implementation started working on that. And it was the first time that medium-scale integrated circuits were used in computers as well. So there was some major steps forward in circuit technology as well. Well, what happened was, while I was working in the slang group, we were asked to write a compiler for PL1, but then I got pulled off of that effort and was asked to join the more broader scale of, since the language is defined, they wanted to continue to monitor the language and see that everything was there and have consistency, etc. And I was assigned to the language control board and assigned to develop the Lisp processing facility for PL1. Now, that was because there wasn't any facility in the original definition. Okay. But what happened, as we'll see in the later slide, is that because of customer demand to deal with certain types of problems, that PL1 or any other programming language would probably not handle effectively, we would need a new facility. And that turned out to be the pointer variable. So, anyhow. But, as I said, this led to the birth of the pointer variable. Now, I had another interesting task, which was an interesting experience in my life. I represented the PL1 programming effort, which was probably, we had about 30, 40 people in Hursley in England, about 20 people in Böblingen in Germany, a few people in Vienna that were actually implementing. And I was in Manhattan. And so I traveled around quite a bit. Okay, but anyhow, I represented PL1 on the OS 360 Exchange Control Board because as this operating system was evolving and becoming more complex, they needed to control it. Okay, and so the various things had representatives to this concern. So I represented PL1 on this Exchange Control Board and observed the entropy as the OS implementation deteriorated. It went from a reasonable set of concepts to chaos. And that has been documented in an interesting book called The Mythical Man Month. Has anybody ever read The Mythical Man Month? It's some people have, but I will refer to that later on. It's an interesting thing to read about. Okay, so I went through that experience. then later on, about 65 or so, I decided that examined how these new processes were being developed by IBM. There were some interesting facilities for the first time as the wide-scale use of microprogramming technology to microprogram the machines so that they would implement similar the same instruction set, okay, with different levels of performance. And so that was interesting. And a number of us got interested in the potential of using microprogramming to do something different with computing, to provide even better instruction sets. Okay, that would be more oriented towards programming languages and other types of things this Friday. So I left the effort and became manager of advanced technology at New York Programming Center. And this was the start of my interest in microprogramming and computer architecture. So after that, I changed from working compilers to being a computer architect. And I since then have designed several processors, including the one I mentioned at the beginning. Was the last one I designed in the early 70s at DataSaab in Linköping. Now, there was an interesting guy that was involved in the Slang effort, the first effort. And that's Don Estridge. Now, it was an interesting and important Slang colleague. He unfortunately died in 85, so we were born the same year, as a matter of fact. He made important contributions to Slang. He was a very impulsive person. Do it! Don't think, do it! Okay. Anyhow, he led one of our efforts in Slang. He led a group of four people, including myself. We locked ourselves in a hotel room in Manhattan and wrote a Fortran compiler over the weekend. Okay, implemented the whole language. Okay, and then it took 4 months to debug it. But Don was a do-it type person. One of the do-its we did was I helped him paint his house in Bethesda, Maryland. For a time that we worked together, we were down in Washington area. So he decided he would have his colleagues come out and help us paint his house in the summer. So we went out there, about four or five of us. He bought a lot of beer and a lot of paint and brushes, etc. So we were painting this house. And it was so dry, this house, that it sucked the paint out of the brushes. So you couldn't paint very fast. So we painted, over the weekend, we painted about a third of his house and drank all of his beer. So he spent the rest of the summer painting himself. Okay. But Don is called the father of the PC era. That's interesting. You probably don't know that. If you go in and do a Google on Don Estridge, you'll find some interesting things. Okay. He became a vice president of IBM, and he led IBM into the PC market. Okay. So he was the guy, again, very impulsive, say, well, we should stop developing these larger machines. The future is these small computers based around microprocessors. Okay, so do it! And if you go down to Coral Gables, Florida, you'll find that he established, there were about 10,000 people employed at IBM in Coral Gables. He was the boss down there. He comes from that area himself originally. But anyhow. Now, the interesting reflection here, Don Estridge made Microsoft. Without Don Estridge, Microsoft probably wouldn't have been where they got. What happened was, in his impulsive ideas, they were implementing an operating system for the IBM PC, OS 2, and were having problems with it. So, well, we got to get out in the market. Get out in the market. So he heard about this other thing called DOS. Okay. Quick and dirty. Quick and dirty OS, right? Okay, and so he made an agreement with Bill Gates to take DOS and put it on the IBM PCs. That made Microsoft. It gave the IBM stamp of approval to Microsoft. Okay? So, that was an interesting point in computer history. Tragically, he died together with his wife at Dallas Airport in 1985 in a plane crash. So, but he was a very personal guy. And during that time, we played bridge almost every night and every lunch. But anyhow, that's another story. Okay, back to the development within PO1 and the pointer variable. I published in the Communication to the ACM in 1967 an article called PO1 List Processing. And we can read the abstract. The concepts of list processing have been introduced into PO1 language. With these new facilities, it's possible to write PO1 procedures that operate on simple and complex data list organizations. Most list processing language have suffered from the inability to deal directly with complex data structures and for their inability to perform complete range of programming language operations upon the data list structures. These two problems have been eliminated in the list processing facilities of the PO1. The basic concepts of list processing and the philosophy of the PO1 language extensions are discussed, in addition to several detailed list processing examples are provided. So that was the first publication about the pointer variable in 67. But it was done in 64. So, the PO1, as I mentioned, lacked facilities for treating linked lists in the original language specification that would, and the compilers were being developed, so that was a problem. However, there was a customer demand. One of the primary customers was the General Motors Research Labs in Warren, Michigan. So they went out to Warren and chatted with them, and they said, well, we would... And at that time, graphics were getting a start as well. So there were separate graphics terminals, but they were programmed on the mainframe. In order to deal with pixels and other types of things, you needed to be able to create linked lists. Okay, so and they wanted to write the driver routines in PO1, not in assembly spoke language. So this was one of the motivations that I went out with an IBM vice president, and I presented a strategy of how we could do that and save the day, and General Motors was still an IBM customer after that. So. But anyhow, there was also a plan to implement the H-level, the largest compiler, for PO1 in PO1 itself. And in the compiler, we're dealing with things like hash tables and things of this variety. It's almost impossible if you don't have pointer variable-like facilities in the language. So that was another facility. So I developed the concepts of pointer and base variables to flexibly treat linked lists. As I mentioned, I had this experience with COBOL data structures earlier, so for me it was rather natural. For many people, it was a completely new way of thinking. So it was not so easy in our language control board to explain what this was and why it was important. But eventually it done. But I did get some interesting feedback during the development of that. I had successive versions of that, including a version of safe pointers, okay, which I called safe pointers. And the problem was implementing safe pointers on the 360, it would be slow as molasses. Every pointer reference would probably crave about 10 times the amount of time. Okay, so that was not accepted. But that affected me later on in my thinking about computers, because the important thing was if we had buried that stuff in the hardware, okay, we probably could have done make pointers very, very safe. Okay? And that's one of the reasons I went over to architecture, is to start exploring those possibilities. But Don Knuth, we mentioned earlier, professor at Stanford, and Doug McElroy, who was at Bell Laboratories. Bell Laboratories was working with MIT and developed probably one of the most safe early operating systems called Multics. And Multics had protection rings and other types of things. And it was implemented in PO1. Okay. So I got some feedback from these guys. I tried to restart the definition of PO1 effort, but would have made life less complex and more useful. Developed a PO1 subset as a program system programming language that was used within IBM and I think is even still used within IBM. PO1 used to implement Multics OS. Bell Labs backed out of the MIT cooperation and based around Multics thinking developed what? Unix. And instead of PO1, they developed C. Okay, and Doug McElroy was the boss for Kerning and Ritchie that he hired in order to do that work. But as time has gone on, many other languages have discovered that pointer variables are very fundamental, so it's been retrofitted into Fortran and COBOL, and of course was in Ada, and even in Pascal and other languages, and some lower level languages for microprocessors like PLM, for example. When used properly, a powerful programming facility used by most programmers, when not used properly, can lead to chaos. How many people have written programs with pointers? Wow! There you go. You understand that statement. Okay. So, as I mentioned, I was awarded this thing. Okay. Well, one of the problems we had, I see I have only 5 minutes left, is that there were problems with this OS 360, which started, as documented in the Mathematical Man Month. Fred was my boss two levels above me when I worked, so I know Fred Brooks quite well. But it started with reasonable concepts and principles and coding conventions. As implementation proceeded, more and more projects requested exceptions. That's why we had the change control board. Document pile grew quickly out of control. From a very simple notebook, which everybody understood, there was shelf space of documents that nobody read anymore. Chaos was a fact. A cast of about 1,000 from around the world joined this deteriorating effort. Every release solved some problems but introduced many more. That changed computing. You don't deliver good products, you deliver a product, or what you call a product. And that mentality is still here today. That's the start of it. So root cause of this was a mismatch between the instruction and the performance goals of the system software. The unnecessary complexity created many, many jobs for consulting companies. So there's a backside to complexity, right? If you make things more complex, then consultants make a hell of a lot of money. Okay, and that actually happened. Fred, in retrospect, has said that OS 360, like Multics, should have been implemented in PO1 using pointers because it became uncontrollable in assembly language code. Well, I got involved with microprogramming, and I've invented some new ideas, which I called T and E machines, which would have implemented compilers and runtime environments in a much more direct way in hardware. I won't go into that. I did want to point to one interesting thing about complexity. In the mid-70s, IBM was given the go-ahead to export 360 technology to the Soviet Union. And Soviet built about 15,000 computers which were 360 compatible, called the Riyadh series. As I said, including they got OS 360. So they got this complex mess of software. Okay? About 1,500. They never mastered the complexity of OS 360. So this probably set Soviet computing technology back at least 20 years. But this was most likely was the intention. Export your complexity to your enemy, because this was in the middle of the Cold War. So anyhow, interesting, several Soviet machines were designing machines along the lines that I was thinking about the proper relationship between programming languages and hardware. They could not produce mass produce them, but they had really good ideas. In fact, the space effort was supported by them. In fact, one machine you can only program in a higher level language. Okay. For applications, at least, anyhow. Interesting. Well, I wind up just saying, and leave you with these words, about the march into the black hole of complexity. Whether it was IBM System 360, there were some pluses and minuses. The hardware software mismatch and attempts to improve, okay, including myself and other people. There were other companies actually looking at similar ideas. Then we got the birth of the microprocessor, which changed hardware economics. We got the early system softwares for microprocessors, which weren't too good, weren't too reliable. We got the Gates-Estridge Agreement. And then we got into this spiral, the Wintel spiral. Faster processors, more memory, add more functionality that nobody needs, right? Faster processors, more functionality. So the world got inundated with the stuff that they really don't need, but it sounded good, right? Okay, you can do all these functions. So we got into the spiral. Now, the solution to all that complexity was what? Middleware, right? Nobody understands that stuff down there. We've got to get some people that understand it and provide a level for us to work at, right? The problem is that middleware hides complexity. It certainly does not remove it. And many of our information security problems are exactly there. Exactly there. We have too many levels, okay, of that to deal with, and we need specialists in all these levels. And when things go wrong, where's the problem? Okay, so this is something very seriously to think about. So we got them to market of inexpensive PCs and the internet. So we build ever increasing complex software on hardware that does not support the reduction of software complexity. The x86 is the worst machine to generate code for. Okay, it produces enormous amounts of code. So perhaps it will require a meltdown of the internet before action is taken to prove the situation. I don't know. Probably won't happen in my lifetime. Now, if you would like to read about this, go back and look at the communications of the ACM 2002. I wrote a viewpoint article called Rebirth of the Computer Industry, where I talk about this problem. But nobody has solved the problem yet. DARPA has a program now to establish what they call clean slate, which is hopefully to go back and re-examine the software-hardware relationship. Okay, but I don't know how they're proceeding. So anyhow, but that's about what I wanted to say. I will wind up saying that in the latter years, I've gone over to a broader perspective of systems thinking and systems engineering. And I'm editor for a book of a book series on systems for college publications in the UK. We have our three first volumes here. I wrote the first volume called A Journey Through the Systems Landscape, which is also available in Russian, and it was supposed to be available in January in Ukrainian. Okay. And it's soon available in French. As a matter of fact. So, okay, but I won't go into that. I spoke about that yesterday, those of you who are here. But anyhow, hopefully that gives you something, and that's all, folks. Do your best to avoid blibbits, right? Thank you very much.
Okay. So, thank you for the excellent presentation and for a walkthrough of computing history.
Right.
As a little memory of your stay in Jøvik, there's a bowl for you.
Thank you. And a bag.
And a bag.
Thank you very much.
Much